Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, for the first time since Tom Watson in 1980, we have a five-time winner on the PGA Tour before the U.S. Open. That, of course, is Scottie Scheffler, who closed out a hard-fought victory on Sunday by one shot over Colin Morikawa. Rex, my opinion, that was a great final round duel at the tournament that I believe epitomizes everything that is good about the PGA Tour, from a good field to a good course to a good host to a good championship test. What stood out to you from Sunday and the week that was at the Memorial?
I was watching the final round and I was workshopping two separate hot takes, and I realized that they were competing hot takes, so I had to stick a pin in one of them. So here's what when I realized that Scottie Scheffler only has shot two over par rounds on a Sunday this year on the PGA Tour, and they happen to be his last two Sundays on the PGA Tour. It's Colonial and then today. And I'm trying to workshop the idea that, maybe he's not quite as sharp. Maybe he's not where he was before. But then you looked at how hard that golf course was. And the Memorial has become more of a U.S. Open than the U.S. Open is. That's the hot take I ended up landing on. Because I was like, it was almost three strokes over par for the field average on Sunday. It's going to be the second hardest course on tour this year, behind only Augusta National. Like, it is whatever Jack Nicklaus wanted it to become. This is it. This has to be the final version of, okay, I'm going to punish these guys as hard as I can. Because you had, arguably right now, and I guess you could put Victor Hovland certainly in the conversation, but between Colin Morikawa and Scottie Scheffler, they are by far the two best iron players in the game right now. You're not going to find anyone that's hitting their irons better than they are. And they couldn't hit a green to save their lives. From the middle of the fairway, from a bunker, from the rough, they couldn't do it. And you realize that if these two can't do it, like, maybe that golf course is just a little too juiced up. So I sort of was wrestled off the idea that, okay, my hot take was going to be, yes, Scottie won, but he clearly is a shell of his former self. That's not the case at all. It was just a really, really hard golf course. And you have to tip the cap to Jack, because he gets pretty much now every year exactly what he wants. And that's a winning score in single digits and guys scratching their heads and no one being able to hit a green in regulation.
I mean, your bad take of the year cannot be, can never be overtaken from the fact that Anthony Kim, you said, deserved a special invitation.
I agree with that.
That one can never be topped.
Still leaning into that one.
In the year 2024. We will touch base again on that one at the end of the year podcast, no doubt, on December 31st. I mean, this was like a perfect golf tournament to me. We had a perfect winner. We had a great leaderboard. We had a great final round duel. On Sunday, like, the weather conditions were perfect. You had just six players breaking par. I mean, Colin Morikawa was one of those. I think he was the only player in the last either 12 groups or 12 players who broke par. I mean, that's exactly what you want to see. And he still shot 71. Like, no one was going out. No one was going out.
Is it exactly what you want to see?
Actually getting, yes, that is exactly what I want to see. Because if you paid attention to Scottie Scheffler's round, now the stats do not look very good. You know, he hit just 7 of 14 fairways. He hit just 10 greens in regulation. But if you're paying attention, like, he was hitting it by and large exactly where he wanted to. Oh, yeah. And a couple times he was just over the back or just off the green. That's why greens in regulation is a little bit of a deceiving stat. But he was spot on for the most part in the final round and just wasn't being rewarded for it. That is when I think you can see the totality of Scottie Scheffler's game, where he's not just this premier driver of the golf ball. He's not just the game's preeminent iron player. I think over the weekend in particular, like you saw on Saturday when they did triple, like, his bounce back ability, I think really speaks to his mental game, the ability to face adversity, overcome adversity, to bounce back. I think shows a certain level of grit and competitiveness and a keen ability to stay in the moment. And so when you put that all for the totality of Scottie Scheffler, it's no surprise that he is by far leaps and bounds the best player on the PGA Tour. And you look at his record now, Rex, particularly in the last 3 months, Bay Hill, TPC Sawgrass, Augusta National, Harbortown, Muirfield Village. I mean, that's a major, a semi-major, and three signature events on the PGA Tour. I mean, he's doing it against the best of the best on the absolute hardest, most complete test that players are facing all season long. Like, you cannot help but be blown away by the play of Scottie Scheffler.
I don't know it was in the PGA Tour notes package, and I'm going to go ahead and attribute it to Jack Ryan just because I feel like he does them even if he's not at tournaments. My guess is he's sitting around on Sunday night telling everyone in his living room to be quiet that he has to grind out a notes package, except, of course, at the Open Championship where we have talked about he seems to want to mail that one. And but the one note that stood out that was in the notes package was only one other player has done what Scotty has done right now, and that's when the Masters, when Arnold Palmer, when Bay Hill, when Memorial and the Players Championship, Tiger Woods. That's the only comp we have right now. And you and I both hate to do that. Like, we go to great lengths not to compare anyone to Tiger Woods because it's always an unfair comparison. But in this particular case, it's really the only competition he has and against himself to a certain degree. It went down since I looked, but he was late in his round and he was picking up almost 14 strokes on the field tee to green. Like, it is a dominant performance. This is what we saw last year when he was sort of in the middle of his putting woes and he still kept finishing runner-up. He still kept finishing third. And you're like, if he just putts average, he's going to win. And that's pretty much what he does now. He's not top 10 in putting, but it's good enough to go with that sublime ball striking that he can separate himself even on a golf course like this. And I always like to do the relative thing because you would say, well, he's not a very good putter. Well, relative to the other putters on the PGA Tour, to be fair. And in this case, he's still number one strokes gained tee to green. That's relative to the best players on the tour and on probably what I would argue the hardest golf course of the year will be, even not statistically, Augusta is ahead of it. That shows you everything you need to know about where Scottie Scheffler's head is right now. I mean, I think you and I talked before the PGA Championship about the opportunity. There was, I think this was your take, that having a kid, so many changes in your life, that this was maybe the door being open. And then, of course, what happened at Valhalla on Friday, getting arrested. How long is this going to hang over his head? Well, that was closed last week. None of it seems to take a toll. He still seems to be the same person. I'm sure it was a pretty emotional week between the combination of having that case dropped against him by the Louisville Police Department and the Grayson Murray, where he got up and spoke. I believe it was on Thursday. There was a moment of silence for Grayson and a bunch of players, and Jack and the commissioner were there. Very emotional week, and yet he still just battles through it. I mean, he is still just a dominant performer.
He, and I feel like you kind of glossed over it. Like, 4 months ago, Scottie Scheffler's putting was all anyone could talk about, and yet he has not just made it into kind of like neutralize that weakness. He's actually turned it into a strength. I mean, he was a top 25 putter on very difficult greens that were lightning fast and very challenging. He didn't make everything he looked at, but he made the putts that he absolutely had to make. It was the 16 footer for par on 16. It was the dicey little 5 footer on 18 to close out the victory. Like, those are the putts that 4 or 5 months ago, everyone's like, Scottie Scheffler, no chance he's making this one. Like, he's completely transformed that part of the game. And so, you know, I think Phil Kenyon obviously deserves a lot of credit. Scottie Scheffler putting in the work and the time and energy to go to the mallet style putter and make those changes and implement those changes and really turn that into a part of his game that I no longer feel like is a crazy bugaboo. And so now, as you spin it ahead to the U.S. Open, I mean, Scotty's a 3-1 favorite. Next closest is Xander Schauffele and Roy McIlroy at 12-1. Like, is there anything, not just course fit, but in Scotty's game that leads you to believe that he will not win the U.S. Open next week?
It's probably too early for jokes, so I'm not going to make a traffic joke because it's probably too early in the game for that. But no, there isn't anything that's going to stop him, to be honest with you. He's the heavy favorite for all the right reasons. And I am going to continue to revisit this, and it'll only get louder if he does win next week at Pinehurst, because imagine.
Detective Brian Gillis is going to be feeling some heat if Scottie Scheffler goes on to win the U.S. Open.
Well, and then we go to the Open Championship, and now we're talking about, well, he could have won the single season Grand Slam. Seems ridiculous.
Plus the players.
My gosh. And two of the signature events, two of the invitationals with Jack's Place and Arnold Palmer. I mean, all of the things that could have transpired. And I hate to put more heat on Brian Gillis because something tells me he has more than enough heat on him right now. But man, it is not going to, that's not going to be a good story. That's going to land very, very squarely on his head. If we get to the point where he goes into the Open Championship and somehow he's able to win that, and he won 3 of 4, and the only thing that stopped him was a traffic stop and getting arrested.
I mean, can you imagine? Like, I actually feel like Pinehurst is the best fit for him that he is actually, that Scottie Scheffler has had in the majors in 2024. having played the golf course, you've covered, this will be your third U.S. Open now. Your fourth. Pinehurst. Yeah, at Pinehurst, 99, 2005, 2014, mm-hmm. and now 2024. Like, there is such a premium on distance control and accuracy with your iron play. Because of the dome greens, like, they may appear big in size, but when you actually get up on the putting surface, like, there's actually not that much room to land your golf ball. Oh, yeah. And that is the hallmark of Scotty's game, is distance control. It is not sexy being able to say that you got 177 yards and hit it on the spot, but Scottie Scheffler does that better than any player in the world. And then, assuming that players do not hit a lot of greens because they are so difficult to hit, it looks like the forecast is actually looks to be pretty hot and steamy. We should get some firm and fast conditions, which I think is pretty exciting. If you miss some greens, like, his short game is otherworldly. Can play myriad shots around the greens with a variety of different clubs, which I feel puts him at a significant advantage versus some of the players, the top players, who I think are pretty one-dimensional when it comes around the greens, where they grab their 60 degree and you saw, like, a Muirfield Village. Like, I don't think Muirfield Village was testing his short game like a Pinehurst would, where you have to really tight clipped Bermuda lies. Like, if you get in thick rough around the greens, you just lay the 60 open, pop it out. Like, Colin Morikawa did that over and over again. He did that to great effectiveness. Pinehurst, you're not going to have that. Some holes you're going to be chipping with a 7-iron. Some holes you're going to be putting. Some holes you're going to be using a 3-wood. Some holes you're going to be hitting a 60 and hitting little nippers. Like, that's what you want to see. And I think Scottie Scheffler, with his arsenal of short game shots, like, it's a perfect fit. Best iron player, and probably now that Spieth no longer holds that title, is probably the best scrambler as well.
Well, and Pinehurst is going to be such a unique test in all of golf. I mean, you would compare it to some of the links courses. Of course, we play for the Open Championship, but even among the U.S. Open venues, Pinehurst stands alone because of the reasons you just pointed out. And you're right. Well, I'm not sure if you were on the conference call last week with the USGA, but they talked kind of at length.
Yeah, I was.
Okay. So you heard it. So they talked at length. The golf course is actually going to play shorter probably this time around than it did the last time in 2014 when Martin Keimer won there. And I think that's by design. I don't know how you interpreted what you heard in that meeting, but it sounds to me like this is what they want is to prove the point that a well-designed golf course doesn't have to be 7,600 yards long, that you can have a decent winning score, whatever that is. They don't want to talk about par, but we all know it's somewhere around 8, 9, 10 under par would be probably where they want to be. You don't have to have a 7,600-yard golf course. I think I got the impression that they want to prove a point. And so you're right. This is going to come down to very, very firm, very, very fast conditions. And how much creativity do you have around a green? You're right. You're not going to be pulling out the 60 every time you miss a green. It's going to take a lot of nuance. It's going to take a lot of imagination. And certainly Scotty has all of those things.
I'm so jazzed. Like, I get up for every major championship. I've been looking forward to this one all year. Really? Having played it at media day about a month ago, like, only heightened my anticipation much, much more on Wednesday. We do our official U.S. Open preview podcast, which obviously you can catch wherever you get your podcasts. Much more to come on that front. Rex, some news over the past couple of days. The transaction subcommittee of the PGA Tour met for 3 hours with the Saudi Public Investment Fund on Friday. Tiger Woods was in attendance. Rory McIlroy was among those who logged on remotely. Rory, when speaking to reporters on Saturday, called it, quote, constructive, productive, collaborative, definitely encouraged. Those are his words exactly. To me, hearing that, Rex, that was a stark contrast from the PGA Championship just less than a month ago, with Rory McIlroy saying that he had the least amount of confidence yet that a deal could get done. He was speaking to reporters, remember, then in the wake of Jimmy Dunn's stepping down from the PGA Tour policy board. What did you make of Rory's comments, and what have you heard on that front with the first in-person meeting between the transaction subcommittee, which is kind of hammering out the initial negotiation with the Saudi PIF?
I think Rory getting on the subcommittee, on the transaction subcommittee, is actually eye-opening for him, and it turns out to be eye-opening for us, because Rory, among everyone who's involved with this, is clearly the most outspoken. He's the one who's willing to go out on a limb and say things like, yes, I'm disappointed, I wish there would be more movement on this, or yes, I'm optimistic, I feel like we're heading in the right direction. I think the last few weeks since he's been put on that committee have probably opened up his eyes to how complicated this is. And we touched on it last week when we did the sort of the June 6th, you know, remembrance of what it was like then and how everything has evolved. Everyone wants a deal or no deal. Like, everyone wants some level of resolution on this, whatever that's going to look like going forward. However, you realize now that this isn't just about two people sitting in a room signing a piece of paper and agreeing to come to some sort of terms. This is a multi-billion dollar deal. The Department of Justice is going to be involved. You have to figure out how you're going to meld all the different products. It's LIV Golf. It's the PGA Tour. It's the DP World Tour. You're going to have to figure out what happens with the players who join LIV. Are they going to be welcome back? Do they even want to come back? Like, and that's not even getting into the finances of it. Like, if you want to break it down, I have someone who's much, much smarter when it comes to these types of deals than me that sort of helps me along in this. And we were talking last week about it. And he goes, you can't imagine how difficult one of these deals is. And then you add the element of just the personal nature of what has transpired between the Public Investment Fund and essentially Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner, who's the front man on this. And then you have to wade through all of those complexities to try to get to a point that you can agree to some sort of terms. And then you hope that you have the votes on the board of directors. So all of these things, I mean, I think everybody wants to see some sort of resolution. But I'm starting to come around to the idea that this was never going to be a quick process. As a matter of fact, I mean, I think now in retrospect, December 31st is almost comical. I'm not quite sure we're going to have something by December 31st of this year at the rate we're going. But if you hear Rory, who probably has been, again, the most outspoken and the most to lose, quite frankly, in this issue, when he has that level of optimism, I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems month to month like they're certainly heading in the right direction. You could have some sort of, you know, substantial progress, significant progress being done potentially by the end of the PGA Tour season, perhaps as we stretch into the fall as well. I was struck, and you are much deeper in this and paying much closer attention to this than I am, but Rory kind of talking about the two parts of this deal, how the transaction subcommittee, of which Rory is now a part, has been meeting three times a week with members of the PIF, not exclusively Yasir, but representatives of the PIF, to kind of hammer out the investment piece of the puzzle. You know, how much are they going to put in, and how that's all going to shake out. Friday's meeting, according to Rory, was more about a vision for the future of golf, what it looks like, what it can look like, how can the Saudis, if they're dumping in $1.5 billion, how can they get a return on that investment, seeing how LIV Golf has not taken off and has produced that. To me, that takeaway thought, okay, if you're sitting down to come up with the vision of the PGA Tour and how could the PIF get a return on their investment? To me, team golf is a huge aspect of what the future has to look like. Because think about this. Even if you bring back all the LIV players, right? If Brooks, if Bryson, DJ, Patrick Reed, whoever you want, were in the Memorial Tournament, that alone is not going to produce significant, substantial value for either the U.S.-based investors with Strategic Sports Group or with the PIF. Like, that alone is not going to be enough. There has to be other ways to generate revenue and to turn this into a profit. To me, it has to include team golf, world concept, and that is such a huge piece that has to be figured out, that even besides the financial spot, which is obviously tricky, especially with the DOJ looking into it. But formulating a vision for what golf is going to look like in 10, 20 years, like, that's going to take a while because everyone's got an idea.
Well, and I think Rory has touched on the idea of a world tour, and we've talked a lot about this. And I think that's probably a direction that if you and I sat down with a blank piece of paper, we could come up with a 15 or 20 event schedule with the best events around the world, with the best players. And I'm not a big fan of 70 player fields, but we can come up with a number that works for everyone. You're right. That product is a better product than what certainly we have right now on both sides, the LIV side and the PGA Tour side. So I think that would be a step in the right direction. To your point, you have to create something new, something better. I always go back to the reference that the NBA created this in-season tournament. And at first, everyone kind of rolled their eyes at it. And then the Lakers win it the first time around, and the media partners like it, and the advertisers like it. And so what Adam Silver was able to do was create something out of thin air that created more profit, more money. So yes, that's exactly what this is going to, whatever PGA Tour Enterprises is going to become, that's exactly the road they have to go down. I was taken by Rory's sort of insistence now at this point, at this juncture, that LIV Golf is probably going to live on its own into the next, at least the next 3, 4, 5 years, until we figure out exactly what the end game is going to be. That makes more sense to me, because to your point, you're right. That's something over and above. Now you have to figure out how to make it all fit together, and you have to figure out how to make sure it's not oversaturated, and you have to find a way to make team golf more acceptable. I went back to, I was kind of doing, when I was doing the June 6th story last year, and one of the things that Jay said at the time, the original proposal from the Public Investment Fund when they wanted to partner with the PGA Tour before they even started LIV Golf was, we'll give you 5% of the league and a team. And that clearly wasn't a good enough carrot, you know, dangling at the end of it. I'm curious now, in retrospect, that if you could make this work, that actually could be a pretty profitable model for the PGA Tour. So now all of a sudden you have created something new, and you have created avenue streams, because not only do you have to feed that money back to PIF, you also have to feed the money back to SSG. So you have two private equities that you have to keep satisfied on some level, and you have to keep the players satisfied. So it's not going to be an easy road to go.
Don't you think, Rex, because there's so clearly two different portions of this deal, the financial aspect and then the vision for the future of the sport. Don't you think there can essentially be a second framework agreement where they come to terms with the Saudis saying, okay, we're going to put in $1.5 to $3 billion in investing in this new PGA Tour enterprises. They can formalize that. The DOJ can begin its inquiry. You can get that ball rolling. And then in the interim say, while we hash this out, while we formalize this, LIV players are welcome to play on the PGA Tour. Like, open that gateway, get that ball rolling, and then you continue the process of kind of evaluating what the future and formulating what that can look like in 2026 and beyond. Like, I don't know why it has to be all at one time. It feels like you can piecemeal this together with certain formalized steps along the way, while also kind of reintegrating the LIV players and making the PGA Tour product even stronger.
I don't know why that would be a framework agreement. I think that would just be...
It's essentially framework agreement 2.0.
It would essentially be the definitive agreement is what that would be. You're right. And would it be a working model? Would there be things you adjusted? Absolutely. There were things that were adjusted after the fact. After the framework agreement was signed by both Yasir and Jay Monahan, they adjusted it. They took out the no poaching clause after it had been signed because the DOJ didn't like the optics of that. So yeah, I see what you're saying right here. And it makes total sense, as does the idea that everyone can keep moving in the same direction. Everything doesn't have to come to a screeching halt, and we don't have to rebuild the house or rebuild the plane while it's in the air, to use the analogy that I always seem to beat up on. You can do this over time. You don't have to snap your fingers and make it happen all at once. And to your point about the financial aspect of it, my understanding is probably the easier part of this, because you've already set the market. The tour has been valued, its own valuation of $12 billion. And you've already come up with terms with SSG for $1.5 billion and another $1.5 billion if they want to invest more. So you have the percentages of what that minority investment looks like. So now all of a sudden you do have a starting point, at least as it applies to what the Department of Justice would want to see and probably what the Saudis want to see.
It's just so PGA Tour that they would want to just package this all in one just monster press release, which they would probably botch the headline on, and roll it out on CNBC or whatever the case may be, where you have the financial aspect and the vision of the sport. You all cram it into one press release and try and have fans decipher it that way. I was thinking, Rex, and I want to get your hot take on this one. Scottie Scheffler just won 5 times on the PGA Tour. When all this is said and done, in 5 years' time, will we view this as one of the best stretches of golf since Tiger Woods? Is Scottie viewed as a player for the ages and a legendary figure? Or in 5 years' time, will this be viewed as a weakened PGA Tour product and that he was not competing week in and week out against the very best players, where everyone from a Brooks to a Bryson to even players like a Taylor Gooch or a David Pooge or an Adrian Meronk were not in the mix week in and week out, which would bolster the strength and the depth of the PGA Tour? How do you think it's going to be remembered?
He did pretty well at the Masters. How many LIV players were there? 18 players, I believe.
Easiest big tournament to win.
Sure. And let's see what happens next week at the US Open. We just got through gushing about he's clearly the favorite. He's in a tier all by himself. I'm sure he'll be the favorite going into the Open championship. I don't see it that way, but I guess I that sounds to me like something that's going to only get heated up on social media. Because you're right. To your point, you could say that both products are watered down. And the only time they're not is during the four majors. So take everything else out of the mix. I would argue. I guess my counterclaim would be take all the live events and all the PGA Tour out of the events out of the mix, and let's just compare them in the major championships when they're going head to head against each other on the same golf course. And I would still say it's been a really dominant run for him.
Speaking of a player who certainly looked like could be a potential foil,
is that not the answer you're expecting? Were you expecting something different?
I knew you weren't gonna take a stand. But a player last year, Rex, who in our opinion. It was not voted that way by the PGA Tour players, of course, was the player of the year in 2023. John Rahm had his another setback this past week at the LIV Houston event, WD, during the second round with an infection in his foot. Apparently he has like a cut between his toes. Sounds very painful. This obviously is coming on the heels of what has been a very disappointing season in 2024. Has not won on the LIV golf circuit, also tied for 45th in his Masters title defense, and then missed the cut at the PGA Championship. How big of a deal is it to you that Rombo is not at full strength after what has already been a disappointing major season?
I think it is a big deal because we've discussed this at length. And I think you and I both keep coming back to the same idea. Let's reconnect after Royal Troon. Let's wait and see how the major championships play out, because again, sounding like a broken record, that's really the only place you get a true litmus test of where someone's game is, because it's the only time you have the top players together again. Now, with an injury, and I'm sure he's going to at least try to tee it up next week at Pinehurst, but if it's that, you're right, that sounds awfully, I mean, it just sounds awful. A cut between your toes, it's infected, yuck, just gross. I can only imagine that's not going to help him be competitive next week. We've already thrown the question out that maybe LIV Golf isn't for him. And I'm not quite sure if we can answer that yet, but the early results are, you just pointed out, didn't play particularly well at the Masters in his title defense, missed the cut at the PGA Championship, hasn't exactly set the world on fire out on LIV Golf. We know John Rahm as a commodity. He runs a little hot. He needs to have that edge to him. And I'm not quite sure he's getting that edge, teeing it up on the third hole in a shotgun start, loud music playing, wearing shorts, everyone's high-fiving. I'm not sure that's the environment that brings out the best in John Rahm. That could change. I could see how he would evolve and learn how, okay, I need to channel my energies in a different way. My bigger concern now is if he's injured going into the U.S. Open, that just gets him one step closer to where I think we've all set the benchmark, and we'll talk on Monday after Royal Troon. And if this season is what we think it is, if it plays out the way it's played out already so far, then yeah, there is going to be a lot of criticism, and I would say justifiably so.
Cut between your toes, a foot infection, and the sandy soil of Pinehurst number two.
That's not just walking around barefooted.
No, but it's certainly uneasy footing, especially when you get off the fairways. Like that could be excruciatingly painful. His agent, John Rahm's agent, your boy Jeff Koski, did say that he fully expects John Rahm to tee it up at Pinehurst. He's expected to speak to the media as well. On Tuesday, I'm with you as it relates to John Rahm. As an observer of the game, I just find it to be a bummer. I mean, this is a player who was in the prime of his career, who, in my opinion, was the player of the year in 2023. Looked like he could have something very compelling going. Scottie Scheffler versus John Rahm. We've been deprived of that. He has not played well in 2024, while Scottie Scheffler has taken his game to new heights. As a golf observer, I just think it's been a bummer of a storyline. You and I are both going up to Pinehurst on Monday morning. You via airplane, trying to get those miles. Me, trying to get that mileage. Thank you, NBC Universal. We should both, though, Rex, be on site around noon Eastern time. Again, we'll be doing the preview podcast on Wednesday. But over the next couple of days, what are you most looking forward to seeing at the beginning of U.S. Open week?
How many text messages did you get angry from fellow from colleagues that were angry that Tiger's talking tomorrow, Monday at 10 a.m.?
I don't have any other friends in the media, so none.
I think you have one, our friend at ESPN. He certainly called me. he wasn't happy about it. I got quite a few texts. I was pretty surprised, and maybe it's just the GWA role or whatever the case may be. Everyone was really upset about it. My response was, I won't be there in time for that press conference.
Speaking of Tiger Woods, by the way. This is Tiger Woods speaking at 10 a.m. Eastern time on Monday of a major week. He is receiving the Bob Jones Award, highest honor for the USGA. However, I think this goes to show just how far Tiger has fallen. He's speaking. This is kind of like the Latin America amateur, like, participant. This you would presume this would be like a Nick Dunlap spot as opposed to a Tiger Woods spot.
Well, just before him is Webb Simpson, so that's probably a better comp. I love Webb, but to be fair, okay, the North Carolina former U.S. Open champion. We're gonna throw him right in after Tiger. I get it. Does it speaks to the expectations? Like, we're gonna walk in and ask him, do you think you can win this week? And he's gonna say, of course I can. And he's going to say all the things that he's always said. But you and I both know the questions we really want to ask have nothing to do with golf. We want to ask how the meeting last week with Yasir went. We want to ask about his thoughts on the Ryder Cup. Still hasn't committed to, or not committed to, being the next U.S. Ryder Cup captain. There's like a dozen other questions I would throw out there before I ever got to, oh yeah, how's your game? How's your body feel?
Like, I've never been less interested in how he's going to play, because we know how he's going to play. He's not, he could make the cut, sure, but he's not going to be competitive. Like, that's just the reality of the situation. You're right. All the questions you want to ask him, he's actually not going to answer. He does a terrible job of actually, like, letting people inside his thought process and what he thinks about a potential deal, what he thinks about the future of the PGA Tour should look like, what he thinks about the Ryder Cup captaincy. Like, these are all pressing questions of the time, and he protects his inner sanctum unlike any player we've ever seen.
And I had this conversation with a player a few days ago, saying it seems like we don't know what goes on behind, you know, the closed doors of the boardroom, but the palace intrigue here is, it seems to me, between Tiger Woods and Patrick Cantlay, who are both on the policy board and very influential voices, that they are not of the same mindset when it comes to whatever is going on between the PGA Tour and the public investment fund. So my question to both Tiger Woods and Patrick Cantlay would be, in your heart of hearts, what's the best case scenario for you 6 years from now? What do you want the landscape to look like? You will be done with golf, so what do you want to leave behind? And I'd like to hear an honest answer from both of them. To your point, we wouldn't get an honest answer from either one of them, but that's kind of where we are right now, because they're at the center, I would argue, at least in my career, in my lifetime covering the PGA Tour, of the most important decisions facing professional golf at this level. And we have no idea what either one of them is actually thinking.
Our colleague Brently Romine will be on site for Tiger Woods' press conference. Hopefully, Brently, since he'll be like one of four media members in attendance, asks some very good questions for us. I'm looking forward to seeing how these players begin to attack and prepare for the unique challenges that you will face at Pinehurst number two. Because when you start to think of the other contenders for the U.S. Open in the non-Scottie Scheffler division, tier two, you might say, on ESPN's tiers, like, Rory's iron play has not been a strength this year. I think Xander Schauffele, he played reasonably well. His ball striking was not up to its typical standard at Muirfield Village. He has a couple days to iron that out as well. But like, Colin Morikawa tends to be pretty one-dimensional around the greens, despite how well he's playing. Victor Hovland, we know about his well-documented struggles with the short game. Bryson DeChambeau, that's not a strength of his game as well. Brooks Koepka, he shot 65 on Sunday in Houston, otherwise had another pretty pedestrian week on LIV Golf as well. John Rahm, injury question. Ludvig Åberg, dealing with, I think, a strained MCL in his knee, something that he's going to be bothered with for the rest of the season. If not Scotty, then who? That's a question that I look forward to answering over these next couple days. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Wanted to get a special shout out to our man, Mark Frazier in Australia. Appreciate the kind words, the warm messages. We promise, folks, daily podcasts each and every day from the U.S. Open. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll have good Wi-Fi signal and connectivity in the media center so we can get those podcasts uploaded as quick as possible so you guys can digest our hot takes from each and every tournament round at the U.S. Open. As mentioned, we'll have the preview podcast as well on Wednesday afternoon that we'll be uploading. And you can always go to mbcsports.com/golf for all of our latest news, notes, and updates from the U.S. Open. Talk to you guys in a couple of days. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Enjoy the start of U.S. Open.
Drive carefully.